The case of missing mom of five, Jennifer Farber Dulos, sparks one of the most high-profile criminal investigations in Connecticut history. It's a headline-grabbing media frenzy of sex, money, and yes, murder. This Killing Time podcast reflects original reporting. It begins with information from the Connecticut State Police Western District Major Crime Squad. Case number CSP 19-00252570.
Cynthia, let's run down the events we've glommed from the highly detailed 33-page police warrant.
Oh, it's amazing.
It's Friday before Memorial Day weekend, 2019. Jennifer has been separated from Fotis for 2 years, and the kids live with her in wealthy New Canaan, Connecticut. It's about 70 miles where Fotis is living with his girlfriend.
Oh, that's Michelle Traconis.
You bet. On that morning of May 24th, Jennifer drops the five children off at private school. Between 8:05 and 10:30 a.m., she returns to her garage at Wells Lane, where something horrific occurs.
At 11:30, the children's nanny, Lauren Almeida, arrives at the New Canaan house. She's surprised to see that Jennifer's 2014 Range Rover is still parked in the garage, because Jennifer had told her she would be taking it into Manhattan because the Rover was easier to park than Jennifer's other car, a massive 2017 Chevy Suburban.
They're very popular here in Connecticut. They're just these huge vehicles you see everywhere.
Why?
Because they like to haul kids around. I don't know. So equipment, sporting equipment,
it's children. It's a kid hauler. It's a kid hauler.
Yeah.
Okay, but that particular Chevy Suburban was not in the garage. Okay, so that raises her curiosity. When the nanny enters the kitchen through the garage, she sees Jennifer's handbag on the floor between the mudroom and the kitchen. Now, on the counter is Jennifer's unopened granola bar and a cold mug of tea. And now, as she's tidying up, what happens next, Pam?
She immediately reaches for a paper towel and notices that the roll needs replacing, and she heads to the pantry to get another one. But to her surprise, there are hardly any left. And Lauren, according to the police report, found, quote, this incredibly strange, end quote, because the night before, she had placed a brand new 12-pack of paper towels in that pantry. She told the cops, quote, I sat there and wondered what had happened last night that they had used 10 rolls of towels, end quote. Lauren continued with her errands. She picks up four of the children from school to eat lunch, and the fifth child is over at a friend's house.
Now at 12:43, right after lunch, Lauren texts Jennifer, but Jennifer doesn't reply, which is highly unusual. Lauren prepares to load the kids up and drive them into the city to meet their mom at their grandma's house, Gloria Farber's house on Fifth Avenue. But before driving off, Lauren notices that the rear mudroom door is unlocked. She texts Jennifer that she expects to arrive with the kids around 2:30 p.m. Again, no reply. And after arriving at Gloria's apartment, the nanny texts Jennifer for a third time. Again, no reply.
Cynthia, I can only imagine the worry that is escalating at this point.
Yeah, it's getting grim.
Now, at 4 p.m., Lauren calls Jennifer's phone, and it goes straight to voicemail.
Jennifer.
Lauren said, quote, immediately my stomach sank, and I had a feeling that something was wrong. In the almost 7 years I have worked for Jennifer, I have never, ever had a hard time reaching her and never had an issue with her phone being off.
And when Jennifer does not show up for the orthodontist appointment at 4:40, full panic sets in. Lauren Almeida tells the police, quote, my first thought was that Fotis did something. Lauren starts calling Gloria and as many of Jennifer's close friends she can reach to see if anyone has heard from her. Here's what Jennifer's friend Carrie Luff told us.
Any of us who knew Jennifer knew her to be the most conscientious person we'd ever met. Incredibly beyond punctual, in fact, early to everything. And if she were in any way waylaid or detained or even just not going to be early, she would have texted, she would have called.
I just can't imagine. And of course, everybody knows that she's going through a very contentious, high conflict divorce. And of course, everybody goes, oh my God, does he have anything to do with it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it had to cross anyone's mind that something amiss had happened to Jennifer.
she would, you know, have made every effort to let people know exactly where she was and that, you know, she was running a little bit late. And the fact that nobody had heard from her was an immediate red flag.
What do you think of Lauren, Jennifer's nanny?
Incredible human being. That says it all. Just an incredible, admirable hero in this entire story. Her presence of mind is amazing. Her loyalty to Jennifer and to her children. Stayed by Jennifer's side when Jennifer and the kids fled FOTUS.
At 6:59 p.m., the New Canaan police receive a 911 call to report Jennifer is missing.
What is your emergency?
A worried friend tells cops that Jennifer was, quote, going through a divorce with a man that has threatened her in the past and owns a gun, end quote.
And that had been something they had discussed as parents, even before having a family, that they would never, ever have a gun in their household. So the fact that he went against that decision and went ahead and purchased one and in fact showed it to her frightened her greatly.
We needed to see for ourselves where the crime occurred. This bucolic neighborhood could have been a setting right out of a Stepford Wives movie.
The town of New Canaan has hosted many famous celebrities, such as Katherine Hagel and comedian David Letterman. Pam, what does the police report say?
The New Canaan Police Department sent some detectives up here. Residence 69 Wells Lane included a three-bay garage. The center bay, which contained a 2014 Range Rover, and the New Canaan police observed spatter stains on the driver's side of the parked Range Rover.
Jennifer was nowhere to be found in the sprawling house, so the local cops call in the big guns, the Western District Major Crime Squad, who sends a crime van along with lead detectives John Kimball and Sergeant Kenneth Ventresca to the scene.
Detectives noted indication the scene had been altered by an attempt to clean it.
Oof.
There's Jennifer Dulles' missing car, the Suburban.
And they probably have known the license plate because
yes.
They gave a description of the car.
Mm-hmm.
And the license plate to police had an APB out for her. They would know what to look for.
Meanwhile, the crime scene unit collects blood evidence from the Land Rover's hood, bumper, and rear fender. They also find bloodstains on the kitchen sink faucet, cabinet door, mudroom doorknob, garage door, and east wall.
We asked famed forensic pathologist Dr. Cyril Wecht what he thought happened on that awful day. Dr. Wecht has consulted on some 40,000 cases in a career that has spanned six decades. Dr. Wecht was the first civilian pathologist who was allowed access to examine President Kennedy's autopsy files, only to discover that JFK's brain was missing.
He's an expert's expert. Other high-profile cases he has consulted on include Elvis Presley, Manson murder victim Sharon Tate, Kurt Cobain, and the still unsolved strangulation murder of child beauty queen JonBenet Ramsey.
Welcome, Dr. Wecht.
Thank you. A pleasure to talk with you, and I appreciate your having contacted me about this interesting case.
Dr. Wecht, we sent you the police report and asked you to review some of that material. With your expertise, what jumps out to you about the blood evidence found in Jennifer's garage?
When you have a blood spatter, that means that some vessel has been perforated, lacerated, and the person is alive, so that the blood literally spatters outward. It's not splatter in medicine. We call it spatter. If someone is dead, then there will be no spattering because there's no cardiac activity providing force for circulating blood. There will be some bleeding, depending on how long the person's been dead, whether the blood has clotted or not, and then also what position they're in. So when you have spattering, that indicates to me that the person was alive when the injuries were inflicted.
I'm wondering if you have your own thoughts about what type of murder weapon could have been used to create the blood spatter.
If it were a transection of neck vessels, then obviously there would have been some kind of a cutting instrument, and that has a wide range obviously, from a small knife to a large knife to something with a sharp edge. Another possibility to consider is that it could have been a striking of the head, with blood then spattering back from vessels beneath the scalp. They too could have produced some spattering, in which case the blunt force instrument could be anything in the world that we call a blunt force instrument that does not have specific cutting edge. Could be something rounded, angular, whatever, and the scalp will bleed. So one would have to try to see exactly, know where the spattering was found in the car, where a person would likely have been sitting. Would this individual, this woman, would she have been behind the wheel as a driver, or would she have been a passenger in the front seat? And to see what those measurements are and what the pattern would seem to indicate. So the instrumentality was not found, and that's, you know, not something that hasn't happened before.
How important is it to find the murder weapon?
May I remind you, in the O.J. Simpson case, no instrumentality was ever found, and yet there were 17 wounds in one victim and 22 wounds in another, and yet no instrumentality or plural instrumentalities were ever found.
Unlike the Simpson case, Dr. Wecht, we do not have a body. What does this report suggest to you?
So when you have spattering, that indicates to me that the person was alive and most likely inside a car for a person to have been subjected to that kind of trauma, that this would have been in the neck region where you have the carotid artery, the jugular vein, and that's what leads to spattering. Blood can fly for several feet depending upon whether the severance is complete or not. So that's what it tells me. And then it says it looked like the scene had been altered by an attempt to clean it. Obviously, then somebody was trying to cover up the blood.
At 7 p.m., New Canaan police find Jennifer's big 2017 Chevy Suburban abandoned in a busy turnout at the southwest corner of the town's famous Waveney Park.
It's about 3 miles from her house. The vehicle's running lights are on, and the transmission is left in reverse. Blood is found on the passenger side door, but no sign of Jennifer.
So we drove to the exact spot at the park where Fotis had dumped Jennifer's Suburban. It's adjacent to where he had already parked an old red Toyota pickup truck.
So what Fotis wanted to do was make it look like Jennifer had driven out of the house on her way to do her normal morning activities. And what he did a switch with the cars. So first, he drives the red pickup truck to this park and parks it in a turnout.
How meticulous he plotted, left these crumbs. This is a murder that has what did you say, musical cars.
Right, musical cars.
So this guy is in a marriage that is not ending well. He's got a lot of problems that we're going to talk about later, but right now, what he plotted was borrowing an employee's 2001 red Toyota pickup truck, and he loaded up, I don't even know, what's a French bicycle?
One you buy in France?
So he drives his employee's old 2001 red Toyota pickup truck with the bike in the back, and he pulls into this little turnout. I see people hiking. It seems to me it's very common because of the popularity of Waveney Park here.
It's not going to be noticed.
Exactly. Captured on surveillance videos along the busy Merritt Parkway that morning were images of a man that certainly looked like Fotis Doulos driving a beat-up old 2001 red Toyota truck, which happened to belong to a Four Group employee. And in the bed of that truck, visible Just barely is Fotis's beloved French bicycle with its unique handlebars.
Police believe Fotis parked the red truck and, wearing a hoodie, bicycled the 3 miles to Jennifer's house and laid in wait to kill her. Painstaking analysis of all kinds of surveillance videos will prove to be crucial in this case.
So I spent my entire bureau career in Connecticut, working out of the New Haven field office, and I worked matters primarily of counterterrorism, but I also worked foreign counterintelligence, counterproliferation. I worked computer crimes, and I also was on a surveillance team.
That's former FBI agent Ken Gray, who spent 24 years working for the New Haven, Connecticut field office.
When you look at the surveillance videos that they found in various locations, they have a timeline from when Jennifer Dulos arrives back home, and then the next sighting is when the vehicle is seen on the highway in the New Canaan area.
You know, he took his time, kind of, you know, after he loaded her into the Suburban, which he left, he took his time kind of, you know, unloading the Suburban and putting on whatever he was going to be putting into the Tacoma truck.
Right. So that was the, you know, to me, that showed the biggest risk he was taking right then and there was the fact that he had the plan of moving her with her vehicle and then having to transfer it to the truck, the Tacoma. That was a huge risk to because that's out in the public, and as you say, that's a very busy place. And so you can account for the 2 hours or so that the murder took place and the cleanup of the house took place. But we don't know whether the body may have been dumped there down in the Waverly Park, or if the body was in the Toyota Tacoma being brought back up all the way back up to the Farmington area.
One more thing I'd like to add, Ken, is that Detective Kimball said that Fotis used zip ties. And I'm wondering if Jennifer was still alive when he transported her out of her home.
You use zip ties to restrain a person if they were dead. Well, you know, it may be to keep their limbs from flopping around as you move them around. So it doesn't, just the use of zip ties does not mean that she was alive, but it also raises the possibility that she may have been alive, that maybe she survived the initial attack.
An anxious family huddles in Gloria Farber's New York City apartment. Lauren Almeida is still calling Jennifer's friends and awaiting instruction from the New Canaan police. Cynthia, here's an interesting item from page 27 from that police report. Cops have already spoken with Fotis briefly and now tell the nanny she can answer his numerous texts.
Yes, and it's 8:41 p.m. already, nearly 12 hours since Jennifer drove into her garage after dropping off the kids at school. Almeida states in the police report, and I quote, "Fotis never asked me how Jennifer was doing the day previously, or when I had last heard from her, or showed any concern about the fact that Jennifer was missing. He was only concerned about his visitation appointment with the kids the next day because the kids really needed him right now," end quote.
So, Fagan, let's revisit the timeline to date. It's Saturday morning, the day after the longest night for the Farber family. They knew Fotis had a gun.
And a hair-trigger temper.
Cops officially called Dulos in for questioning at the New Canaan Station House by noon Saturday. This is the day after Jennifer disappeared. But he isn't in any rush to help find his missing wife. In fact, he arrives a jaw-dropping 3 hours late to a sit-down with detectives.
Not a good start if you're pretending to be the worried husband, albeit estranged husband, and now the prime suspect. Yet, the very late Fotis asked the cops if there's any news on his wife's disappearance. And to the detective's amazement, he declines to help look for her. I mean, imagine declining to look for your missing wife.
What the hell? So stunned were the detectives that when Fotis's attorney at the time, Jacob Pietranker, entered the New Canaan police headquarters, they asked him if his client was declining to look for his wife. The answer was yes. And there's more. New Canaan Detective Christopher Allegro asked Fotis to turn over his cell phone, which he hands over. Immediately, the detective places the phone on airplane mode to prevent data from being remotely erased.
Meanwhile, the clock is ticking. A sliver of hope remains. Could Jennifer still be alive? Then, where was Jennifer?
You have a very wealthy spouse who has disappeared. It is a mystery. I want to emphasize that. You know, there's allegations that that police have made that Jennifer Doulos has been murdered.
Attorney John Schoenhorn represents Michelle Traconis, the former lover of Fotis Doulos and an alleged accomplice.
I've been practicing criminal defense law for now over 38 years. I'm the former president of the Connecticut Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. This is not my first high-profile case.
Does your client, Michelle Traconis, believe Fotis killed Jennifer?
Well, first of all, we're not sure that she's actually deceased. But whether or not Fotis Doulos had anything to do with her disappearance, or whether, I don't know, maybe she took her own life, maybe someone else had a motive to go after her, whether or not, for that matter, Fotis Doulos was framed, those are things I don't know, and neither does she.
Michelle Traconis is charged with conspiracy to commit murder and tampering with evidence. She is currently out on $2.1 million bond.
Let them prove that, but whether or not Doulos did that, I suggest that it's going to be very difficult for them to prove that Michelle Traconis literally had a clue about any of this ahead of time. In order to prove a conspiracy, you have to show you had an agreement to do something illegal.
John, before you came on board as Michelle's attorney, she was interviewed three times by police within days of Jennifer's disappearance.
The first thing I say is there were three separate interviews, one on June 2nd, one on June 6th, and then another on August 13th. And I'm going to emphasize, my client was trying to help them. My client had a different lawyer.
In one of those early interviews, a detective asked if she knows where Jennifer is.
We feel confident in a few things. First of all, I'm going to say you planned this. There was a lot of pre-planning that went into this.
So this is property that you and Fotis have been on. But are you saying that you have no specific knowledge that Jennifer Doulos' body is in here? Because you don't know?
I mean, I can tell you where we ride moto.
Michelle is referring to off-road motorcycles that she and Fotis often rode on the property at 80 Mountain Spring. So who is Fotis' lover, the now 46-year-old Michelle Traconis?
She was a single mother with a preteen daughter living in Florida. She meets a man who everyone else says told her and told them that he was in the midst of a divorce, and but it was an amicable divorce, and he invited her to move to Connecticut, where I'm not sure, I don't know if she'd ever even set foot in this state before. But here was a man who was very athletic, very international. Keep in mind, Michelle was born in the United States when her father was doing his residency. So she's a U.S. citizen, but she grew up in South America. Her parents were from Venezuela, but because of the political situation there, as I understand it, the family moved at an early age to Argentina, where she grew up in Buenos Aires. When she moved to the States, she lived in Miami. She has other family there, sister and whatnot, where she lived. And then everybody speaks Spanish. You know, that's her native language. She knows English.
The notorious pair first met in 2016. At the time, Michelle was 42 with a 12-year-old daughter fathered by a former Argentinian Olympic skier. She had been bouncing around the rich sporting playgrounds in the U.S., South America, and the Middle East.
And you know, Cynthia, I saw this wild photo of Sharon and Ozzy Osbourne. Yes, that's Sharon and Ozzy Osbourne standing at some ski resort with Michelle Traconis and her then-boyfriend.
Oh, my God, you can't make this up, can you? Sharon and Ozzy Osbourne ski bums?
She meets this international guy at a, and she meets him at a water skiing competition where the children are also involved. She is herself has been a competitive water skier. As I understand it, she's one of the top 50 water skiers in the Western Hemisphere.
Jennifer's best friend, Carrie Luff, recalled when Michelle became an issue in Jennifer's marriage. How were you aware there were problems in the marriage? And just give me a sense of that.
Did he ever hit her? And the response is not that is on record. When she learned of not just the immediate instance of infidelity, but that there had been prior infidelity. And she told Fotis that that was a deal breaker for her, and he refused to entertain the idea of divorce, and in fact informed her that he intended to bring his new girlfriend and her child into their family home.
That was the last straw for Jennifer.
She had been feeling as though she, you know, had to do something, feeling like the physical sense that she was being replaced. So she, you know, did everything by the book. She had a safe plan in place, took action to keep her children safe, to get herself and the kids out of the house, and then rented a home in New Canaan.
So in the middle of the night, Jennifer packs up the kids and left the family home on Jefferson Lane in Farmington and headed to a rental in New Canaan, 70 miles away. Divorce was the next step in March 2017. Fotis was stunned and called 911.
I'm worried about my wife and kids because they left to go to New York, and I haven't been able to get in touch with them.
Okay. Where they were going to New York. What's the license plate on the car?
Excuse me?
What's the license plate on the car?
I have to get them for you.
Okay. Who's the car registered to?
It's registered to my wife's name, Jennifer Dulos.
Her date of birth?
It's September 27, 1968. And then they were driving with our baby here. I can give you her car as well.
What kind of car were they driving?
It was a Range Rover. They're not answering their cell phones.
Cynthia, it's important to note here that the they that Fotis is talking about is Jennifer, their five children, and the nanny, Lauren Almeida, who is a hero in our story.
The ever-faithful Lauren is by her side.
And that is the babysitter. Her name is Lauren.
Her last name?
Yes, Almeida. Almeida.
How many kids? Two?
Five.
Five kids? Okay, and how long ago did they leave Connecticut?
I want to say 4:34.
And they're supposed to be in New York tonight?
I've been texting, and I see that the texts are being delivered, but nobody's responding to me.
Okay. What's your name?
It's Fotis, F-O-T-I-S.
Okay.
Last name is Dulos, D-U-L-O-S.
Okay, I'll send an officer over to speak with you, okay? You're at 4 Jefferson Crossing?
Yes.
Okay.
What time do you think he'll be here?
He should be there shortly. He's he's not too far, okay?
Okay, very good. Thank you so much.
Okay,
thank you.
Bye.
Well, I certainly can't attempt to get into his mind, but in my observations from the outside, it is that he viewed anything that was not a full triumph as losing, and he refused to lose.
But if Jennifer thought she and the kids were out of harm's way, she was dead wrong.
Episode 3 of Murder in the Morning, A Divorce from Hell.
Poor lady, what she went through. I mean, she was the Stepford wife.